And do you know whose fault that is? Lactose intolerant people, third generation Mongols, Dalmatian owners, Mounties, and the whole screaming crybaby I have a swimmer's ear crowd. In other words, the people who are pulling this country down. They make me want to heave my meat and potatoes lunch onto the nearest wall. Let's go to the phones. Eric from Ketchum, Ohio, you're on the Wolf Report.
Long-time listener, first-time caller. You didn't mention beekeepers or people who spray when they talk. I think they're a big part of why I'm stuck in traffic after a bad day of sales calls. And I'll take my response in the form of a good spanking.
You wish, buddy. But you are right about the beekeepers with their screwy-looking masks. What are they hiding? And who says they're not killing off their own bees so they can get on welfare? Sadie in Utica, you're on the Wolf Report.
Mega, you betches. Thanks for all you do to keep this nation strong. I was in Nova Scotia last week, and I was surprised at the line of Canadian cars waiting at the border to come here. No wonder my son is getting D's and F's in middle school.
You betcha. Hey, Bobby, send Sadie one of our Wolf Report We Hate Them travel mugs. Nova Scotia, Labrador, New Brunswick, it's all the same. They want to come here with their low IQs and their fish breath and destroy everything we've worked so hard for. Look, we're almost out of time here, and I want to address the charge that's come up by some so-called media critics. They say this show feeds on petty hatreds and manufactures divisions that barely even exist. And what I'm here to tell you is, dig a little deeper, okay? You're going to find that most of them are either xylophone players or allergic to penicillin or both. Like the new so-called Miss USA. Yeah, right. That's all we have time for today. Until tomorrow, remember, find somebody different and shove them really hard. Coming up next, some pansy, cream puff, wise guy, college boy, bleeding heart, crypto-socialist, Ralph Nader, toady named Colin something-something.
That's me, and we are going to talk a little bit about how media feeds on divisions today. With us is Eric Deggans. He's the author of Race Baiter, How Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. He's been doing media criticism down in Florida in the Florida in the newspaper business. He's about to gravitate or move. Gravitate? That's not the right word. Move to
gravitas. Move about to teleport.
He's going to do a teleport with gravitas. That's gravitate. So he's going to move over to NPR. He's going to be, in fact, their new television critic starting at the end of this month. Tonight, he'll be leading me, Susan Campbell, and Frank Harris at a town hall or town meeting style discussion about media and race at Playhouse on Park in West Hartford at 7 p.m. This is all under the guidance of the Noah Webster House, and tickets are available at the door. They're $10. So see, join us tonight at Playhouse on Park. We'll mention that a few times as we go along today. You'll be able to meet Eric, and I'm sure get your copy of Race Baiter signed. As we go along here, too, we'd love to hear from you. Notwithstanding that introduction, we will take phone calls. 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. Eric Deggans, your book sprawls around to a lot of different corners of the media, ranging from cable news, you know, talk shows to reality shows to what's even in sort of more fictional stuff and, of course, the wonderful world of talk radio. A common theme, though, is that the media has many biases. But would it be fair to begin by saying that the media has one bias, and that's towards money? I mean, they want to make a lot of money, and they don't really care how they do it.
Well, first of all, making me follow that introduction is like I can't believe that I have to follow that.
A lot of people.
Anything I say is going to be completely boring after that. But I guess, in a way, you're right. But I would say that media have values. Media are based in – different media outlets are based in a value system. Mm. And for example, here on this platform, your goal isn't necessarily to make money because everybody knows that public radio doesn't make money. Mm. So you have a different value system at play, and so you have different strategies for reaching your listeners and different strategies for success. The success means something different here than it means if you work at Fox News Channel, than it means if you work at the local NBC affiliate. So money is a big part for most of those platforms, and of course, that's what I talk about in the book a lot. But I wouldn't say that the core of every media, the core of everything that media does is money. And in fact, the challenge for today's consumer is to figure out what is that core value that's motivating that media outlet, because it tells you why they are showing you what they show you.
I think sort of cases in point are a good way to go. And obviously, as a media critic in Tampa, you had a bird's eye view of the Trayvon Martin case. So maybe we can sort of take that as kind of a case study. As
sure.
you watched, particularly, I mean, your book begins with cable news. As you watched how that story unfolded, and it did a lot of its unfolding on cable news, what kinds of different value systems, just to use what you just said, came into play? What did you see happening?
Well, what I saw in media in general was that different platforms had different goals for covering that story, and so they operated in different ways. Television in particular is a very emotional medium. Broadcasting in general is, but television especially, and cable television in particular. So covering the Trayvon Martin trial was all about emotion. It was all about exciting emotion in the target audience of whoever was watching that TV outlet. So if you're Fox News, your position is that here is a stand-up guy who's being unfairly railroaded by the political correctness police in Florida and across the world. If you're MSNBC, then your perspective is that here is a person of color who's being victimized, and Al Sharpton's going to ride to his rescue. And if you're CNN, what you're saying is there's a bunch of questions out there that are very controversial, and let's sort of pick at them like raw nerves to excite a response from the audience. And so that's the different kind of covers that you saw to make some sort of crude analogies in cable television. Print was much more about trying to own the facts of the story. So the Orlando Sentinel and the Miami Herald in particular were very aggressive about just trying to figure out what happened, what were the facts, who did what when. And they competed really intensely on that. And then social media was about spurring people to action. So what you had was a lot of petitions, and you had calls for people to go to protests. And the fact that the story became such a big story, it started in social media because the call to action was, hey, pay attention to this story that people don't know anything about. So that's how those different platforms tended to work.
You know, given how some of those platforms work, and let's just stay with cable news for a second, because, I mean, I don't particularly choose to watch most of that stuff, whether it's MSNBC or Fox News. Or I mean, I can get my headache organically.
Yeah, you could grab a hammer and smack yourself in the head a couple times and do the job
right.
Just fine.
But is it a mistake to expect more from them? I mean, they're not about the getting of wisdom. They're about this the kind of churning that you just described. I mean, is it a mistake to assume that they'll ever be better than that?
Well, the one thing, I mean, I have some friends who work in cable TV news, so I'll try to be nice and not be incredibly cynical. But what I say in part is that you do have to look at how do these platforms judge success? And for cable news, it's about ratings and money. So how do they get ratings and money? And it's by doing what they do.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing them refine that strategy to greater and greater lengths. We're not seeing people pull back from partisanship. We're not seeing people pull back from opinionating. We're not seeing people pull back from reporting on things before they even know what's going on. What we're seeing is that they're doing more of it, and they're being more sophisticated about it. So this is how they make money. So until someone comes along and figures out a way to make more money in cable news doing the kind of journalism that maybe you and I would prefer, this is what we're stuck with in cable news. Now, there are some advantages to that. There's some stuff about that style of programming. I mean, I sometimes want to see people on opposite sides of an issue get in the ring and kind of slug it out. The problem I have with Fox News and MSNBC in particular is that those fights are lopsided because the whole point of the channel is to echo a point of view of their target audience. So Fox News's target audience is older, conservative, overwhelmingly white, more male than female. So what they do, and you know, one quick way to judge this, because my book is a media literacy book and it's a race literacy book.
Mm.
So on the media literacy side, one way to figure out the target audience of a platform is to just look at who the biggest personalities are.
Mm.
So you look at Fox News and you see middle-aged white guys and really great-looking white women, for the most part, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's their target audience, the people who find those people compelling and attractive and desirable, right? So they're going to talk about issues in a certain way. MSNBC is going to talk about issues in a different way, and they're going to frame it so that their side always comes out on top, and that's something that I'm not interested in.
Although, as you point out in the book, in terms of looking at who their big personalities are, looking at any of these places, you don't see an exceptionally diverse group of people. I mean, MSNBC is a bunch of white guys and Rachel Maddow and a few. I mean, MSNBC hasn't done that good a job.
MSNBC is more diverse than any other cable channel. Mm-hmm. They do have Al Sharpton. They do have Melissa Harris Perry on the weekends. They do have Richard Louie, who shares a show early in the morning. They do have Touré, who's one of the four hosts on the cycle. They do have Alex Wagner, who she's not African-American, but she is biracial. So they are way more diverse than, say, CNN. Mm. if you look at CNN, when I wrote the book, after I think 2 or 3 o'clock, a person of color was not an anchor on that show until the end of the broadcast day. So CNN, the supposed straight down the middle, play it fair network, has a real problem with diversity amongst its anchors. But MSNBC, again, part of their profit margin, part of why they're successful, is that they are the most popular cable network with African Americans. They're the most popular cable network with people of color. So one reason why their anchor team is more diverse is because that's the target audience that they're appealing to.
You know, you talk about just now about sort of sometimes you want to see people get in the ring and maybe slug out a big issue. But this is unsatisfying because it's always sort of tilted a certain way. It's always
if the argument is gamed, then it's not a real discussion.
And some of this obviously is just a product of media fragmentation. You know, I grew up in an era where if CBS under Walter Cronkite or NBC as embodied by Huntley and Brinkley, if they didn't produce programming that all Americans could at least conceivably consume, they were dead. They were dead in the water. That was the greatest way to get fired, would be to produce anything that resembled niche programming. Now,
right.
Here you have a completely different kind of marketplace. It's a fractured marketplace. It is assumed, really, that it's going to be incredibly difficult for anyone except possibly the declining major networks to produce that kind of programming. So the goal really, I mean, the way to win the game is to produce programming that's targeted at some fragment of the audience.
Well, you know, the great boon of our current media structure is also, I think, the biggest drawback, which is that now we're at a point where people who have specific interests can be super served. You know, you don't when we were younger, as you said, there were four, maybe five major broadcasters in a market. And if you didn't like how they provided the news, you know, you were out of luck. But nowadays, there's so many different people providing news and information that if you're interested in science fiction news, you go to Sci-Fi. If you're interested in sports, you go to ESPN. If all you want is this or all you want is that, there is a channel out there somewhere that serves your needs. And that's wonderful as a consumer. But the flip side of that is that there are some outlets that use prejudice and racism and stereotypes and sexism and other isms to draw a crowd. And they also use those ideas to keep that crowd from going to other channels. So when Fox News tells its audience that we're fair and balanced, they're not just saying we do a great product. They're saying the other guys are lying to you. The other guys are biased and they won't admit it. The other guys are giving you incorrect information, and we're the ones who are telling you what's going on as it really is. And that's something that's unusual. And I think if you have a bunch of different channels doing that, then what ends up happening is it destroys people's confidence in journalism in general. So unfortunately, we've created this wide-ranging media structure that not only has some channels that depend on these awful ideas to draw people in, but it also destroys people's confidence in journalism in general. So, there's a dark side to this great cornucopia of media that we're now sort of living with.
If you want to get into this conversation, 860-275-7266. Scott was just about to get on the air, and I didn't pick him up fast enough. Be patient. 860-275-7266. You may tweet us at WNPRColin. So, you know, we want to – there's something that we want to hear, something that you and I both want to hear occasionally, which is a real discussion of the issues that isn't that way. It's not stacked a certain way. For me, I have to say, I mean, my politics are certainly left of center. I never watched MSNBC except when it was on in my gym, and this guy Ed Schultz would come on, and I'm like, oh my God, I almost feel like switching sides. He's obnoxious. And for me, even something like Democracy Now, people would say, listen to Amy Goodman, and I would listen, and I would think, well, that's just people telling me what I already think, or, you know, it just, what's the point? There's no audience there except the people who already think this stuff. So who's doing it right? Where can we go to get the thing that you and I both say we want?
Man, I am going to sound like such a shill, but let me tell you, public broadcasting is a good place to hear some of this stuff.
But some people would say no. Some people would say no. It's its own kind of left of center echo chamber.
Well, if it's done right, it's not that. Mm-hmm. The thing that you're always kind of trying to balance, I think. I'm going to get in trouble saying this, but I think one of the reasons why Fox News has been so successful is because it's come to conservatives and presented itself as a solution to a problem that actually kind of existed, which is this sense that because we have certain things in journalism, we have this social justice imperative where we're sticking up for the little guy and we're trying to hold big institutions accountable and we're trying to be the voice of the voiceless. And, you know, a lot of that stuff can feel very left of center to people who are politically conservative. So Fox News comes and says, you know, we're going to offer you news that's free from that liberal bias stuff. But what it does is it takes this sort of gentle tendency towards some liberal values, particularly because of our journalistic inclination, and they go way over to the right, and they present this stuff that's just incredibly tilted to one political point of view. And then MSNBC comes along and says, well, if there's this channel way over here, well, then we're going to over here to the left, or not way over to the left, but we're going to go over to the left a little bit more than you would normally see in media, and will be the counterpoint. And so I think that's the problem, is that a gentle sort of tilting to the left sometimes has been the excuse to go way over to the right by the Rush Limbaughs and the Sean Hannitys and the Fox Newses of the world. And it doesn't really balance. It's overbalance. It's oversaturation. It is not compensation for some of the gentle liberalism that we used to see in our mainstream journalism contact. But, you know, I feel like if you watch Charlie Rose, if you listen to Fresh Air, if you listen to your show or shows like this, I've been on shows like this across the country. I think hosts are aware of their liberal or their political leanings, and they try to compensate for that, and they try to probe the ideas and be honest brokers. To me, that's the main thing. I want somebody who is an honest broker delivering the news and information and sparking these conversations. I'm not going to shy away from what my political points of view are, but I'm not going to game the conversation so that my side always wins. I'm going to come with research and facts and knowledge, and then I'm going to win the argument because I'm right. I'm not going to win the argument because I gamed it. And that's the only thing I ask, really. And really, that's the only thing I think conservatives should ask, is that people be honest brokers.
We're talking to Eric Deggans. His new book is Race Baiter, and Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. Eric Deggans and I and Susan Campbell and Frank Harris will all be at Playhouse on Park in West Hartford tonight at 7 p.m. Tickets are available at the door for $10. It's going to be a discussion, a town meeting-style discussion about media and race. You know, one thing that I can contribute tonight to this conversation, assuming I can contribute to this conversation, is an unusual perspective for 16 years.
You were born a poor black child in Illinois.
Well, there's that. Well, poor black female child, actually.
Oh, but, my God.
There's that. But for 16 years, I worked in commercial talk radio. I was the one left-of-center voice on a station that otherwise carried Rush Limbaugh. I followed Rush Limbaugh every day.
What station?
WTIC. It's a 50,000-watt CBS-owned station here in this market.
Wow.
And on that kind of radio, and we'll talk a little bit about your chapter on talk radio, too, as we go along. But on that kind of radio, you get rewarded for being kind of an extreme version of who you really are. In other words, take who you are and exaggerate it, or at least make it much more unalloyed than it really is. You know, erase any doubts you have about your own position.
Exactly.
You know, any nuances that you see that might even conceivably favor the other side, and go on the air as that person every day. Where I do think, not to congratulate public radio, because I think it has its own set of pitfalls, but you get a little bit more rewarded here for being capable of examining more than one side of an issue.
Yeah, I agree. And probably what you saw happen was that as conservative talk became more of a business strategy, guys like you got pushed off the radio. Guys like Bob Lassiter, guys like Lionel, they found it increasingly hard.
Fired is the word you're looking for.
Yeah, exactly. I was trying to be nice. Canceled. Yeah. And that's simply, you know, you had these guys controlling these corporations. And sure, I think, you know, the Mays family who ran Clear Channel at one point were conservative. But really they were doing it because it made money. But what happened was, you know, you had this period where conservative talk took over and then became very strident, particularly in the wake of the success of President Obama. And now guys like Rush Limbaugh used to be entertaining. And I could, you know, I didn't agree with him politically, but I could listen to him and sort of, you know, enjoy this radio master who loved giving liberals a hard time, just enjoy the show. And you can't do that anymore because he is so strident and mean. And Glenn Beck is the same way. He was a younger version of Rush Limbaugh when he started. He was also kind of fun-loving. He was also a prankster. He was from, you know, the top 40 side, the radio zoo side of the equation.
Yeah, he started out in New Haven.
And now you listen to him, and he's talking about buying bunkers, and he's talking about the end times. I mean, this guy is so far away from fun, you cannot believe it. And I talk to news directors, I talk to programming directors, I talk to fans, and they say, I don't want to listen to these guys anymore, not because of their politics, but because they're just not fun anymore. And so I think that's where we're at this point where talk radio doesn't quite know what to do with itself. Sports radio is ascending because it's thought there's a place where you can have conflict and conversation without the meanness of politics. But I'm not sure that that's the answer. What I do know is that I think political talk needs to reinvent itself, and it does need to become more subtle. It does need to offer a wider wealth of views. It's so ironic that we have this wealth of media platforms, but the views on them have become more restricted because people are trying to make such an impact.
Well, I think that medium is in trouble. I mean, the metrics suggest that it's in trouble. Of course, a lot of it's on an AM band, which the New York Times front page story about a week ago pointed out the entire AM band is itself in a lot of trouble.
Yep.
And certainly the station that I left was number two in the market when I left. It's 8 or 9, depending on which book has just come out these days. So,
I saw a study when I was writing about the rise of sports talk where it said – some outrageous number of people never listen to AM, like 60, 70% or something.
I used to run into people. I gave a little talk out in Litchfield, which is sort of a pretty Tony suburb here of Connecticut. And I gave a little talk one day. This was around 2007 or 2008. And at the end of it, people came up to me and they said, we've never heard of you. Now you're on the radio. Tell me. And so they would say, where is this radio station? And I would say, well, it's 1080 AM. And they would look at me and they would say, I don't think my car has AM radio. And I would say, I bet your car does. I mean, it's a Volvo, but I bet you it has AM radio on it. But people,
it might as well have not.
What a wasteland. Hey, we got a call from Eric, another Eric in Glastonbury, who I think thinks that we're pretty biased here. Hi, Eric.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. You're on the air.
I agree with what you're saying on the show, that there's generally media bias. I think it extends actually beyond the media. There's a lot of different, you know, areas, including, education, you know, where people try to tell you what to think rather than sort of let you get to your own conclusion. That's one point. And the second point is I think it's ironic that you guys are having a show on NPR, which I also think is a biased show. And, you know, your guest made the point that, the journalistic tendency tends to be a soft left. You know, and Fox News has gone hard right, and then MSNBC has sort of kind of gone a little left, which is in and of itself, I think, a biased comment, ironically. MSNBC, it seems to me, watching both Fox News and MSNBC, and I kind of give both little credibility, but MSNBC itself is, I think, probably more extreme than Fox News.
Well, that may be me misconstruing of Eric Deggans' remark. In your book, you're extremely tough on MSNBC in a lot of different ways.
I am tough on MSNBC, but I don't agree with what the caller said. I don't believe that MSNBC is as far to the left as Fox News is to the right. And I think one of the problems that we have in this country is that the far left in this country has no real mainstream voice. And I mean, if you're really on the left in this country, you're a communist or you're a socialist or you're one of these groups that we have sort of demonized over the years because they are the political systems that control our adversaries geopolitically. But in point of fact, if you're really left wing, that's the area of politics that you're on, and there really are no major politicians who are communist or socialist in this country. There's no major media platform that advocates that political point of view. So to say that MSNBC is way out on the far left, I mean, in America, the far left is cut off from the mainstream of political conversation. So it's a bit of a misnomer.
But to extend that analogy, you know, to the right, then you'd have to say, well, fascism, right? Fascism isn't covered anywhere.
I think there are some people who would look at some of the things that Fox News talks about and says, that's some pretty extreme right points of view. It's saying that it's okay to religiously and racially profile people when they go on aircraft or because we've had problems with terrorism.
That's a long way from fascism.
All I'm saying is I think if you were to look at the views of most of the political commentators, particularly the most popular commentators on Fox, and you plot them on a graph and you say, what are they advocating regarding monetary policy? What are they advocating regarding immigration? What are they advocating regarding social issues? And then you did the same thing with MSNBC. You would find that there are a ton of people in the Green Party. There are a ton of people in established political systems that aren't even communist who are to the left of MSNBC, way to the left. And they feel dissatisfied. I mean, one reason why Democracy Now! Exists is because there are people on the far left who don't like MSNBC, who think it carries water for the Democratic administration, and feel like there are several hosts on that show that won't criticize the president, particularly Al Sharpton, when he deserves to be criticized. It's a critical call. I'm a media critic, and in my opinion, from years and years of watching these shows, I don't think they're analogous.
I think it's possible for both of you to be somewhat right, too, not to be a horrible synthesizer. But I mean,
not to be all public radio on us.
I mean, I think Eric's point, we're going to go to a break here, but before we do, Eric's point, at least partly, is, and I would agree with it, too, that whatever MSNBC has carved out as its ideological niche, and we can talk about, you know, where it falls on the actual spectrum of real political thought. Whatever it is, it pursues it as feverishly and at times as unpleasantly as Fox News pursues its position. Now,
sure.
Now, your claim is, and I think it's also correct, that in some ways they're mirroring what's happened in actual American politics, which is that what you would ordinarily be the far left is so ghettoized as to be a microscopic and invisible point of view. I mean, not just in the media, but in politics itself. There's like Dennis Kucinich and nobody.
I think the fact that there are some people who actually believe that Obama is a socialist tells you that people don't know what socialism is. And they don't know what socialism is because they don't encounter it in their lives. They don't meet a political candidate who espouses that point of view. They can't participate in a party that advances candidates for election who advocate that point of view. The only thing they know about socialism is its name and the fact that it's been demonized in this country. And I'm not a socialist. I'm not advocating socialism. I'm just saying there's a lot of people throwing that word around that have no idea what it means. And they don't know what it means because it doesn't really exist as a potent political force in this country. And so if you look at MSNBC and say that's far left, to a political scientist, it's kind of laughable because it's not.
All right, we got to grab a quick break here. We're talking to Eric Deggans. Eric Deggans is the author of Race Baiter. He will be at Playhouse on Park tonight at 7 p.m. So will I, so will Susan Campbell and Frank Harris. We'll be back after this.
Sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds. You're beginning to believe the illusions we're spinning here. You're beginning to think that the tube is reality and that your own lives are unreal. You do whatever the tube tells you. You dress like the tube. You ate like the tube. You raise your children.
And we're back. We're back with Eric Deggans. We want to hear from you, too, 860-275-7266. Tonight we'll be at Playhouse on Park on behalf of the Noah Webster House. Tickets are $10 at the door. If you mention Fox News, they're $15. No, I'm just kidding about that. That's untrue.
Hey, man, you're trying to get me fired before I even start in NPR.
I want to, actually, as long as I'm plugging something, I want to quickly mention something because it does a little bit tie into what we're talking about today. Coming up on October 2nd at Watkinson School, also at 7 p.m., I'm hosting a forum about ethical consumerism, about what happens when people try to marry their values to their consumer behavior in restaurants, in shopping malls, wherever. And we have an amazing panel. I mean, this is like a really good panel. I'm going to be telling you more about the panel and more about the program in the days to come. But it's October 2nd. Circle it on your calendar. Go to watkinson.org for more details about it. This is going to be a very, very cool and very interesting discussion. We're also having a very cool and interesting discussion right now with Eric Deggans, and he's about to start in a couple of weeks as NPR's new TV critic. Towards the end of the show, we want to see if we can get a little sense of what that's going to be like for Eric. But as we're going along here, the book is – I wish we had time to cover every chapter in the book because chapter in the book is really interesting. One of the chapters in the book is sort of about how President Obama himself is processed. And you kind of alluded to that a few seconds ago, you know, sort of how do you criticize President Obama? What if you feel like the left-wing media isn't criticizing President Obama enough? And I always mispronounce his name, and I get emails afterwards telling me I'm not getting it right. But is it Ta-Nehisi Coates? How do you say that?
I always thought it was Ta-Nehisi.
That's what I thought, too. But then I get emails saying I'm getting it wrong. Anyway.
I have no idea.
I love this guy. Anyway, he's like one of my favorite writers, particularly on this topic. Wrote this amazing piece, cover story in The Atlantic a few months ago about this, tying it into the Trayvon Martin case, too. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about how you see, how you process all this, how you see the media processing the incredibly complex question of having an African-American president.
Well, it's interesting because I think some people felt that when America elected our first non-white president, that they could breathe a sigh of relief. We're done. Now we have achieved diversity, you know, and now we can stop talking about it. And to their dismay, what they have found is that we talk about race and difference now more than ever, because what is happening is that people of color are entering areas of life that we haven't seen before, and people of color and women are getting power in ways we haven't seen before. The power that Latinos and Hispanics have exerted on the political process by showing that they could make a difference in getting Barack Obama a second term and pushing the GOP to face immigration questions that they would really rather not talk about, I think that in itself shows that people who were normally a little more disenfranchised now have a bit more power. And what's interesting about having an African-American president, a person who self-identifies as a black man, is that just by having a black president, all of a sudden we're pushed to talk about race more. And we have a black president who chose to be black in a way. He has an African father and a white mother. And he has self-identified as black. And when people try to say, you're biracial, you're part white too, he's like, I understand my heritage, but I self-identify as a black man. That's what he says. And I say in the book that I think you can sort of define race in America in a few ways. You look at how the world sees you. You look at how the person self-identifies. You look at what their familial history is, and you also look at who they surround themselves with. And so I use it as a contrary example, somebody like Nicole Richie, who you might remember her. She's kind of a reality TV star, best friend of Paris Hilton.
You've watched so much more reality TV than I have. I feel so bad for you reading this book.
But I've gotten paid for it, so really don't feel too bad for me. But Nicole Richie, she is she looks white. She is blonde. If you didn't know her history, you would assume she was a white woman. But she is, in fact, part white and part Hispanic, and she's the adopted child of Lionel and Brenda Ritchie, who are African-American people.
Or even to get closer to the bone, I mean, you could do the same thing. You did do the same thing in the book to a certain degree with Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman. George Zimmerman is theoretically understandable as half Latino. I think his mother's Peruvian or something.
Well, like George Zimmerman, again, self-identifies as Hispanic. Mm-hmm. He is listed as Hispanic on his driver's license and his voting registration before any of this stuff with Trayvon Martin happened. According to his family, he speaks Spanish, and his mother is from Latin America. So, you know, he self-identifies as a Hispanic the same way that President Obama does. But just to get back to the Nicole Ritchie thing quickly, I feel like she looks white. As far as I know, she seems to surround herself with white people. She seems to date white men and seems to sort of, and, you know, Paris Hilton is her best friend, right? So even though she has a familial heritage that is more diverse, and even though she was raised by black parents, I think the world kind of treats her like a white woman because there's these other elements in her life that don't fit what we're used to seeing for people of color. So there are some people who kind of get to choose how they're seen or how they self-identify or what they tell the world who they are. And that's something that's new for America, too. It used to be you could just look at somebody and assume what their race was, assume what their cultural identity was, assume what their cultural heritage was. But now we have mixed and matched enough that people can choose. They can choose to reveal themselves.
Some people can choose. It's not wholly true, too. I mean, I remember during the 2008 campaign, President Obama, then Senator Obama said, well, I think it turns out I'm pretty black when I'm trying to hail a cab.
Right.
Which might not be a problem that George Zimmerman has. I mean, there are, as you said, among your criteria, one of the criteria is how the society identifies to you and reacts to your appearance, to everything else about you, how you get read, basically, by society.
Most definitely. But there's ways you can present yourself to change that as well. So there are some people, at the very least, who can choose how they appear and thus how the world views them and thus how they are treated. And I think President Obama kind of pushes us to face that more often as well. So some people, I think, thought that reaching this milestone of having a black president would mean that we were, quote unquote, post-racial and we could stop talking about race. But what we know now is that as we get more diverse, we will talk about this more because we will have more difference, we'll have more diversity, we'll have more issues that we have to deal with. One of the things I find kind of interesting is that commentators sometimes criticize President Obama for, quote unquote, inserting himself into issues. He spoke out when Henry Louis Gates, a famous African-American professor at Harvard, was arrested inside his home after police had gotten a report that said that there might be burglars around. The police knew he was Henry Louis Gates. They knew he owned the house. They didn't like how he was speaking to him, so they arrested him. Now, Barack Obama spoke out on it and said that he thought police acted stupidly. There was this huge backlash. He had to kind of take it back. But what people sometimes don't realize is that he was responding to a question he was asked by a journalist at the end of a press conference about something totally different. Mm-hmm. And so what happens sometimes is we turn to our black president for guidance or comment on these issues, and then when he says something, he gets hammered for it. So it's interesting to see that I say in the book, I can't wait to read the book that President Obama writes about race when he gets out of the White House.
Well, yeah, and there's a whole other contingent of people who really didn't think that President Obama found his voice on Trayvon Martin until the post-verdict remarks, you know, that at that point they said, wow, that's what we've been waiting for him to say about a whole bunch of stuff, maybe since the Gates thing where maybe he got a little quieter after the Gates thing because the backlash was so hard. Maybe he got a little bit more cautious. But there's a whole bunch of people who feel like he didn't talk about race anywhere near enough, and they were glad to hear him do it post-verdict.
Yeah, I still think that President Obama's approach seems to be mostly that he's president for everybody and that he's going to avoid talking about race unless he absolutely has to. And I think in the Trayvon Martin situation, he had to say something. And then, you know, when he said, if I had a son, he looks like Trayvon, he'd look like Trayvon, that became such a symbol of the pressure to have George Zimmerman prosecuted that when George Zimmerman was acquitted, he kind of had to say something then, too. I mean, he would have been asked that question at every press conference mm-hmm. that he ever held until he said something. So I think he reaches points. He reaches these crisis points where he says, okay, I got to talk about this. Mm-hmm. And so then when he does, he often talks about it in a way that's very thoughtful and very enlightening and very interesting. But I think he also realizes that he gets hurt with certain voters every time he talks about race, and that is something he has to do sparingly. And I hope that once he's an ex-president, that he will find the time to talk more about it. I think in the same way that Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton were able to do things as ex-presidents that they couldn't do as president, I think if we want Barack Obama to be our godfather on race, that's going to happen after he gets out of the White House.
Then we got one call. This show is speeding by like a bullet train right now. But here's John in West Hartford. Hi, John. You still there? No, we were warned that John might have to hang up. All right.
Sorry, John.
So we got some other calls.
I'm
here.
Talking too much. I'm sorry, John.
Well, that's what you're here to do, actually. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back. We won't have anywhere near enough time when we come back, but we'll come back anyway.
What's the media? Who's tricking you? Who's controlling you? Blame the immigrants. Islamophobia. That's ignorance.
Today's show was produced by Patrick Scahill, a vegetarian, Betsy Kaplan, who rides a bike, and me. I have dreadlocks, so I think you know what kind of people I'm talking about here. We disgust me. Our interns are Tess Aronson and Jonathan Scranton. The part of Bill Curry was played by Joe Pine. Tomorrow, a show about infinity. And now, back to Colin.
I was so glad to see Joe Pine make an appearance in Eric Dennis.
I was going to say, Joe Pine, oh my God.
My favorite Joe Pine moment, and you may not know this story, is you may not even know this particular thing about Joe Pine, but when he was interviewing Frank Zappa, he said to Frank Zappa, "You have long hair. I guess that makes you a girl." And Frank Zappa said, "You have a wooden leg. I guess that makes you a table."
I remember that. Yeah.
Anyway, if you don't get enough of Eric Deggans today, and you probably won't, we have so many things that we haven't gotten to yet, 860-275-7266 is the number to call. But if you didn't get enough, tonight, come to Playhouse on Park in West Hartford at 7 p.m. He'll be there. So will I. So will Susan Campbell and Frank Harris. Tickets are available at the door for $10, and it all goes to support the wonderful activities of the Noah Webster House. All right, so many things to talk about. So you're coming to NPR. You're going to be their television critic.
Yep.
One of the things that you tackle in the book is the whole Juan Williams saga at NPR, which right. I'm sure you had to sort of process and digest in your own way
sure.
To make your peace with NPR. So as you sort of look at all that.
There was no big deal for me from my situation. No.
That did, as a critic, though, how did you feel when Juan Williams was cashiered for, you know, pretty selective understanding of what his remarks actually were?
Well, I've written about this before, and I feel like what happened to Juan was more a sense that they had not really established ground rules for him about what they expected from him when he was talking on other platforms, and I think he had kind of resisted the idea that they could tell him mm-hmm. what he could say on other platforms. So you had an essential kind of disagreement about how much authority NPR could exert over what he said when he wasn't on NPR. And that is something that's bound to create a problem eventually when the other platforms that he's on are cable TV, where you have to make extreme statements. And so for me personally, I would have an agreement with my employer that I'm going on these other channels. Here's how I talk when I'm on these other channels. And we have to agree that that's what's going to happen. It seemed like that agreement was not really understood in the same way by both parties. And so when he said something that caused a lot of controversy, NPR reacted the way he did, and he reacted the way he did. And I've written before that I felt like it was just a central sort of misunderstanding. They didn't agree on, you know, the ground rules of their relationship, and that was their problem.
As TV critic for NPR, obviously you'll grow into the job and you'll discover things about how you're going to do the job that you don't know now. But, you know, as a media writer in the past, you've kind of delved into a lot of areas that for the most part, NPR doesn't get into. I think when people hear NPR TV critic, they think, oh, he's going to talk about Orange is the New Black and Breaking Bad.
Which
and,
he is,
and
by
Down,
the way.
And Downton Abbey. You know, the kinds of things that we like. Whereas, you know, you spend a lot of time kind of decoding reality TV and decoding a lot of these cable news things that, you know. And are you going to take that act as and make it part of your NPR act?
Well, I think NPR has always said that the mission is to be smart, to be unexpected, and to expose the way that television is revealing us, and also expose the way that television is changing and how the way television is changing us, not to get too meta about it. So I think the whole point is for me to do stories that surprise listeners and that tell them about things they don't expect and that talk about these issues and changes in ways that they don't expect. So I think we're totally on the same page, me and NPR, on that notion. And I've been doing freelance commentaries for NPR for 2.5 years now, and I've been doing those sorts of things. I did a commentary about how FX's, a lot of FX's series, were really about untraditional working class white males, the kind of guys that you never see get to be the smart guy on television, the kind of guys that you never get to see sort of be successful in the center of shows on television unless they're being made fun of. But FX, through Sons of Anarchy, through Justified, they've brought a different vision to that kind of character that we don't normally see. But nobody ever thought of their shows that way. They thought, no, Sons of Anarchy is this outlaw biker drama, and Justified is this cool Elmore Leonard thing. And that's true. They are those things. But they're also an exploration of working class white males in a way that we don't often see on television. That's smart and insightful. And so, you know, I did that piece. That was my first piece for NPR like 2.5 years ago. So I've been talking about this stuff. Yeah, I'm just going to talk about it a little bit more.
One of the things that I look forward to are some Eric Deggans' analyses of comedy on television. Saturday Night Live is about to launch.
I know where you're going.
Well, where am I going?
They just announced 6 new cast members for Saturday Night Live, and as far as we can tell, none of them are people of color, and only one of them is a woman.
So it's Jay Farrow and Kenan Thompson are going to be carrying that load again, right?
Yeah, and as a much more as an astute commentator besides myself wrote online, part of the problem is that they don't have any black females on the show, which forces the black males to play women all the time. when you have people like Alicia Keys and Rihanna and Oprah Winfrey, sort of making big moves in pop culture and entertainment, you know, well, who's going to play them? It's going to have to be Jay Farrow or Kenan. Maybe they'll put blackface on one of the white women. So in a weird way, as our country gets more diverse, it requires other institutions to become more diverse in ways that they don't expect or in ways that they have not done. And I think Saturday Night Live is a good example. We're at a point where Hispanics right now, in the next couple of years, demographers predict that the under 18 population is going to become majority minority in just a few years, right? And that's because of the rise of Latinos and Hispanics in this country. Saturday Night Live does not have a Hispanic person on the cast. Mm. Yeah. how do you do that if you're a satire show that's going to look at the world? How do you ignore a good 15-20% of the population that just doesn't make sense? And to me, you look at entertainment and you see Jennifer Lopez and you see Benjamin Bratt and you see Sofia Vergara and you see all these great Hispanic and Latino actors and performers, and why wouldn't you want to be in that business? Why wouldn't you want to have a Sofia Vergara on Saturday Night Live? That would be amazing. So, I don't understand the logic. I don't understand why they don't try harder to find people in unexpected places. I don't know why they don't realize that Kenan Thompson and Jay Farrell do a great job. Why not find some other people like that? I don't understand any of it.
Right. And if the media critic for TV critic for NPR doesn't understand it, who's going to understand it?
Who's going to understand it?
Lauren
Michaels will understand it.
You're going to have to come back because there's a whole bunch of other stuff I want to talk about. I want to talk a lot about comedy. In fact, we're in the town where Dave Chappelle got really mad at us. So that's like a whole other story.
Boy, I saw that YouTube video, man.
that was Hartford. All right. So we got to go, though. But do feel free to come by tonight. 7 p.m. Playhouse on the Park in West Hartford. It's all about the Noah Webster House. Eric will be there. I'll be there. Susan Campbell, Frank Harris. Thanks to everybody who helped out today.
Dave Chappelle will not be there.
No, Dave Chappelle. He didn't like us.
Pill is late, engine Mexican. It looks real rough for your Mexican. That's why I don't rhyme for the sake of riddling. False media, we don't need it, do we? America's lost somewhere inside of Littleton. 11 million children are on Ritalin. That's why I don't rhyme for the sake of riddling. False media, we don't need it, do we? False media, we don't need it, do we? False media, we don't need it, do we? False media, we don't need it, do we?
I'm Kyon Wolf, Greg from West Hartford. Go ahead.
Hi, Kyon. This is Greg from West Hartford. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Why does everybody who calls into a radio show have to ask, how are you doing? I'm fine. Get to your comment or question.
Well, sorry. I just thought it'd be